The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So I am sure you must be so tired of people always talking about the end of history. I think Kant felt that way about the Critique of Pure Reason. You know, I've written other things. But a few of the reviewers have actually tried to draw a link between end of history and this book, and some have even suggested that you might be repudiating your views. I don't think you are myself. But can you draw that linkage for us? There was a kind of caricature of your position that was widespread in a lot of the reviews. How did you see what you actually claimed in that book, and how does that relate to what you're claiming now?
No, it's a reasonable question. Well, first of all, the end of history was not about the termination of history. It was really end in the sense of direction or goal, and it was a concept in European philosophy that Hegel and Marx had. So the Marxists for 150 years believed that we were heading towards an end of history, and that end of history was going to be communism. And there was a point in the late 1980s when I was looking around the world, and it seemed to me that's not going to happen. We're not going to get to that end of history, and to the extent that we're heading historically in any direction, it's going to be towards what the Marxists used to call bourgeois liberal democracy, and that's really the, you know, the genuine end of history. And so that was the, you know, that was the argument I made, and that's it's something I still believe. I just don't believe that we're heading towards a Taliban-type society. I don't think anybody, even I don't think in Afghanistan, really want to live under that kind of a regime. And I don't think we actually want to live, you know, like the Chinese other regimes around the world. So I do think that liberal democracy is still pretty much the type of order of choice. Now, so you get into the current book. 20 years have passed since I wrote The End of History. I've learned a few things. I've been watching the world, and it does seem to me that probably the thing that has struck me the most is that democracy is based on a certain set of institutions. And in the book, I say that there's really three important ones. You have to have a state that can use power and enforce rules. You need a rule of law that limits power to rules that the community agrees on, and you need some mechanism of accountability. That's what a liberal democracy is all about, but it is extremely hard to actually set up working institutions like in all three of those categories. And we've been really disappointed in what's happened in, you know, Eastern Europe and, you know, other would-be democracies where we thought they were going to make a transition. We thought the Russians would, join the club, and, you know, here you are in this Petro, you know, kind of mafia state. So this book is really a kind of rethinking, you know, how you actually institutionalize democracy and make it sustainable.
Some reviewers have seen a much greater appreciation for the contingency of history in this book. You do wonderful empirical work looking at particular cultures, China, India, and so on, and it's led at least some of the people, you know, reading it to think, well, are you in any sense suggesting that modern states are prisoners of their history? To what extent can modern states break away from what seems their fate, given the history?
Yeah. Well, that's it's an interesting question. I this book really goes back far. I mean, we really start with, you know, the chimpanzee-like progenitors of human beings, and so we're talking about a few hundred thousand years of political development. And, you know, one of the things that struck me in doing the research for the book is that you've got these long continuities. I'll just give you one example: India versus China. India today is a democracy. China is an authoritarian, centralized state. And a lot of people would attribute this difference to colonialism. The British were the colonial masters of India, bequeathed it a democracy, and so forth. And I began to realize that this is just nonsense, that there's a, you know, 2,500-year history behind this, because if you look at the long sweep of Chinese history, they unify as a modern state in 221 BC. The state gets going. It prevents the emergence of a civil society and challenges to itself, and it's unified then for the next 2,300 years, with a few exceptions, you know, between dynasties, whereas India has always been divided. It's only unified for a couple of periods, very brief periods, under the Mauryas in the 3rd century BC, and then under the Guptas, and then finally the Mughals and the British come in and try to do it from the outside. But nobody has ever succeeded in establishing a dictatorship in India, and the reason is that Indian society is just too damn, you know, strong. I mean, you've got castes and religion and a well-organized society that just resists this kind of tyrannical power. And so you begin to realize that the fact that the Indians can't decide on building, you know, dams and water supplies the way the Chinese can is actually a reflection of the fact that they couldn't build the equivalent of the Great Wall when the Chinese were doing this, you know, a couple thousand years ago.
I'd actually thought that I might not ask you a question about anything after 200 BC, just so you couldn't show this magisterial sweep over many cultures, but then I changed my mind. There is some question, though, about how much you can trace, right, a linear, you know, history from way back to the present. One question I wanted to ask you at dinner, so I'll ask you now. You started out as a Soviet expert. You paid a lot of attention to China recently. Very good Wall Street Journal piece, I thought, about, you know, whether this, you know, the uprising fervor of the Mideast would come to China. Do you think much about Russia anymore? I mean, there we do have a culture that now seems to have a strong man who doesn't want to give way to democracy. Depending how you interpret things, you have Medvedev who maybe is trying to push Putin toward democracy. What do you think about Russia these days?
Well, I've got a chapter actually on Russia in this current book, which ends really with kind of the 19th century. And Russia was really different right from the start from the rest of Europe, because there was never a congealing of Russian society to resist the centralization of the czars. And in fact, under Peter the Great, you know, when the nobility and gentry in England were standing up to the English king in Parliament and saying, "You can't tax us without our consent," Peter the Great just drafted them all into his army, and he, you know, made them officers, and they were all part of this extremely powerful centralized state. And in many respects, that old czarist system persists, because back then they didn't have a really competent bureaucracy like the Chinese. It was all these shadowy figures, and that's exactly the system that Putin's got right now. You know, we think that maybe Putin is worth $30-40 billion because he's got all these business interests, or the heads of the FSB, you know, the secret police, and, you know, but nobody really understands how that government works. And so this really poorly institutionalized quasi-democracy, because they do have elections, and, you know, Putin is genuinely popular, but it's a kind of reflection, I think, of these deeper trends in Russian history towards both a strong state and a weak civil society that hasn't been able to resist very well.
Yeah, I know, having taught there for a few years, I mean, I always wonder about the real popularity of the leaders, because, you know, it's not a place where some stranger comes to your apartment and says, "So what do you think of Mr. Putin?" Where people are going to give, you know, honest answers, and yet that's all the data we have.
The other important point, of course, is oil and energy, because, you know, that's what keeps them alive. And, you know, I think people genuinely admire the Chinese because they've created this economic miracle. They work hard. They, you know, they're competitive in all these different fields. Now it's, you know, wind energy and you know, green this and green that. The Russians, you know, what? Well, actually, I actually buy Russian manufactured products, because I've got a high-end stereo system that uses vacuum tubes, and it turns out that the Russians are the only people that still manufacture vacuum tubes. But in class, you know, I've asked my students, you know, how many of you have ever bought anything that's ever been made in Russia? And absolutely nobody, you know, raises their hand, because, you know, they haven't mastered, you know, a modern economy, basically. You know?
Well, yeah, they certainly don't want to start on Russian vodka. Right?
No, so well.
One of the things I have always liked about your work as a critic is that it seems there's a really rich vein of common sense that runs through your analysis. And part of that common sense is not looking for just a single explanation. Some reviewers, for instance, have compared your book to Jared Diamond's in that respect. I think you yourself acknowledge that that's an important book. What do you think about this idea of, you know, people writing books that say, well, this is the engine of history, that's the engine of history? Does one have to really always have what you call a soup of causes?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, it's hard to, if you take my route where you say there's lots of different things that caused the rise of democracy or the state or some, you know, it's hard to express this in a soundbite. Yeah. And I think that people, you know, want to get noticed because they want to say, I have the master key that's going to unlock the secrets of the universe. And Jared Diamond, actually, you know, to his credit, he did a pretty good job. I mean, he really is a kind of geographical determinist, and he makes a pretty good argument for why you get different forms of, you know, society in mountainous areas versus deserts versus, you know, river basins and so forth. But he's, you know, by far the best. But, you know, most people that get into this basically just want to flog, you know, one particular idea. And it's never right because, you know, life is just, it's way too complicated.
I wonder what the title of your book would have been if it was a Jared, you know, instead of guns and germs, like rule of law, ideas, et cetera, like 17 clauses.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, probably would not have worked. Do you feel comfortable as at the dinner just now, when people want you to link your kind of overriding thesis of history to very immediate events? So, okay, you know how states are going to develop. What's going to happen in Libya? I mean,
no, actually not at all, because, you know, I think that one of the problems with academics is that they develop this narrow academic specialty, and they think it's self-justifying without asking themselves, why is this humanly important for anybody alive today? And they ride in jargon because they have to get tenure, and their tenure is going to be determined by the three other people in the country that have their particular academic specialty. And the result is it's A, unreadable, but it's also irrelevant to, you know, to anyone's life. And in my kind of education, I actually started out like you in philosophy. I did classics as an undergraduate and learned Greek so I could read Plato and Aristotle. And then when I got to graduate school, I completely flip-flopped. I got into the Harvard Government Department under false circumstances because I had really wanted to study political theory. But one of my friends that was teaching there said, no, you can't get in because there's too much competition. But say you want to do foreign policy and security, because we don't get very many applicants in that area. So I lied about my real interests, and I said, I want to do national security. And then I got there and said, hey, this is pretty interesting. And so I switched into something extremely practical. And I never, you know, regretted that, because when you start thinking about policy issues, at the end, you know, you always on the last page want to say, you know, what are the three or four conclusions that are actionable today that are going to affect people's lives? And I think if more academics asked themselves that, they would write better scholarship, because they would then, you know, have some grounding in why this is important to anyone.
You're reminding me, I saw recently Bill Moyers at Penn, and at the end of a presentation he brought up his wife, who's been his co-producer, you know, for decades. And she said, well, the thing I'm always reminding him is at the end of any project, documentary, book, or so on, the two questions that people have, so what, and what does it have to do with me? And if you haven't answered those questions, go back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
And so,
and incidentally, just in terms of this book on political order, it was actually motivated in the first instance by a practical question, because I had been doing this consulting work. I've been running an international development program at Johns Hopkins over the last few years, in which you're training students to go out to work for the World Bank or the USAID, helping poor countries develop institutions. And so I'd spent a lot of time in Melanesia, which, if you don't know, is a bunch of islands: Papua New Guinea, Timor Leste, the Solomons, Vanuatu, so forth. They're kind of north and east of Australia, and they really today are the only truly pristine surviving tribal societies, which is why anthropologists love going there, on which these colonial authorities have then placed a modern state, a Westminster system like the British and Australians have, and it just doesn't work very well. And you know, I was asked by the World Bank and the Australian Aid Agency to go and, you know, spend time there and interview people and see, you know, why is it that their governance programs aren't actually yielding results. And it was, you know, one of the most fascinating confrontations with a society that was at a completely different level of political development. And that's actually where I got this idea for the book. I said, you know, how did anyone get out of this? Because everybody, including all the Germanic barbarians that populated Europe and the Greeks and Romans and the Chinese, Indians, Arabs, everybody has lived in this kind of society. And yet, you know, now we have a world in which they all live in modern states. And how did anyone make that transition? And, you know, strangely enough, there isn't a book that can, you know, can tell you about that.
Well, how would you, though, answer those two questions that Mrs. Moyers put? I mean, for people in the audience, what's the answer to the so what question about your book, and what does it have to do with them? I mean, if you read your book, what?
Well, okay, so to go back to the thing that animated this, we have engaged in all these nation-building projects around the world that have been integral now to American foreign policy. Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Haiti, in all of these places, we would benefit greatly if these countries could actually be like Denmark, have democratic, stable, strong, non-corrupt, you know, governments that actually delivered services. We'd die for Denmark and Afghanistan right now. And we don't get to Denmark. You know, somehow this, you know, eludes us. And everybody's kind of scratching their heads saying, you know, why is it so hard to, you know, to create a democracy and or forget democracy, just a government that can actually enforce, enforce laws. And I think the reason is that there is a historical amnesia about, you know, how we got to the modern world. And we don't realize how long and accidental and complex that process was. And then we expect, you know, in the course of a 3-4 year intervention that we're going to replicate in some culturally very different country a process that took, you know, centuries to unfold when it happened in Denmark or in England or in, you know, Japan or in China or other parts of the world.
So let me connect that to one of the famous moments in your career when, you know, according to some, you had a falling out with the neocons.
Yeah.
Part of it, I'm sure, was ideological. Maybe all of it was ideological, or that I gather some personal relationships got bruised and so on. But was part of that your feeling that you just simply can't easily jumpstart the building of democracy in places, and you continue to feel that? You think we should do anything as the United States to help jumpstart democracy someplace, or you just have to let processes take their natural course?
No, absolutely. There was a intimate connection there because, you know, I didn't disagree with this idea that if you could get rid of Saddam Hussein, you ought to do it, you know, because this guy is he's a lunatic. He's got so much blood on his hands. But the question is, if the United States takes this on, can we actually, you know, now that you own this country, you know, can you actually help them to create a better kind of society, a more democratic one, and so forth? And as I started listening to the Bush administration in 2002 argue, and as, you know, and living in Washington, you know, you have all sorts of sources of information about, you know, the plans and what's really going on, and it was just obvious that they thought that they were going to invade Iraq. They're going to turn it over to Ahmed Chalabi. It was going to become a democracy, and then they're going to literally walk away in 6 months. I mean, I think that's what Dom Rumsfeld had in his, you know, in the back of his mind. And, you know, having, you know, spent a lot of time studying American interventions in places like Nicaragua and El Salvador and Vietnam and a lot of other places, and having thought about this problem of how do you create political institutions, I just thought this was, it's totally irresponsible to, you know, to do something like that. So that was actually the, you know, the starting point of the break. Mm-hmm. And it was worse, you know, when, I mean, it turned out that not only did they not, you know, find any weapons of mass destruction, but it turned out that even the minimal planning that I thought they must have been undertaking, you know, didn't exist. And so, you know, that's why you got this catastrophe following.
Well, so it's a kind of natural segue, I mean, to ask about at least one of the situations we're in now, you know, with Libya. The other night I was in a discussion with some people who practice international law. I studied it but don't practice it. One of the persons there was making the argument that why don't we just knock out Gaddafi, as seems maybe is the plan of the last day or two when they're attacking his compound. And the argument this guy was making was that we don't need the Security Council. He blew out the Pan Am plane. We have a perfect right to go directly after him. Somebody, the other guy came in, no, you're misunderstanding international law and so on. I know you're not an international lawyer and you approach these things, you know, from a different perspective, but when you do think of the UN's role in these situations and the role of individual states, since so much of your book is about the state, what power do you think states should still have individually without the imprimatur of the UN to take action for humanitarian reasons or other reasons?
Look, I think that we still live in a world of sovereign states, and states, you know, when their core interests are threatened, they're going to take care of themselves regardless of what the UN or any international body thinks. But we also live in a very interdependent, globalized world where we need a lot of cooperation. And so I don't think that you can take an extreme view, you know, in either direction. If you had to depend on the UN Security Council with Russia and China and their vetoes out there, to justify, you know, action, you'll never do anything. You know, it's really a blocked institution. On the other hand, it was a huge mistake for the Bush administration to go into Iraq without any kind of UN imprimatur, because we need friends. You know, it's not a legal question. It's more a political question that what the UN signifies is it then says to other countries it's okay to help the United States. And I think that this was kind of a reflection of this 20-year period after the fall of the Berlin Wall, where the United States thought it was King Kong because, you know, it was the only big hegemonic power and we could just do anything, and everybody was so, you know, indecisive that we would just take care of things. And I think we just vastly overestimated our power to affect them.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about the practical politics of it, because, you know, as one person in that conversation was making the point that, well, you know, in the 1950s, nobody thought of the Security Council as a legitimating institution because, you know, you had the Soviet Union and they couldn't confer legitimacy. But it seems pretty clear, right, that if everybody starts going after their enemy, well, Russia will be in Georgia and China will be in India and we'll see all sorts of bad stuff.
That's right.
I promised you I'd ask you some questions you're not used to answering. So here's one, maybe. I've always been curious, and it's part of your biography that you started out on the State Department policy team. What does the State Department policy team do? Because I just imagine all these people sitting in the State Department generating policy, and then somebody walks in the room and says, the White House doesn't like that policy. Change your policy. What actually happens in the State Department policy team?
Policy planning staff. Well, usually nothing.
So in the cutbacks, that can just be wiped off. Okay.
Well, okay. So
you save money already.
Any of you that have worked in a big bureaucracy know that there's a big difference between a staff and a line organization, and the policy planning staff is a staff organization that's attached directly to the Secretary of State, and all the line bureaus that are actually responsible for the day-to-day management of foreign policy don't like staff organizations and will do everything they can to prevent it from having any impact on what they do. So the policy planning staff was created by George Marshall right after World War II when he was Secretary of State. It was the first policy planning director was George Kennan. And he used it to design the Marshall Plan, basically. So Kennan took his staff on a retreat to a little place outside of Washington. They sat there for 2 weeks. They came up with the structure of the Marshall Plan. They gave it to Marshall. He gave the famous speech at Harvard, and the rest is history. And so that's the way the policy planning staff is supposed to work. And then when Acheson became Secretary of State, he told Kennan, okay, you're now subordinated to the European Affairs Bureau. And Kennan resigned the next day because he said, you know, if I don't have direct access to the secretary, it's a meaningless position. And so the staff has actually had a good impact when the Secretary of State wants to use it for some specific purpose. So, for example, Henry Kissinger used that staff basically as his speechwriting outfit. And speechwriting may seem like just, you know, wordsmithing. But for Secretary of State, it's actually very important because he's the one that defines, or she now, is the one that defines, you know, what America's role in the world is. And so Winston Lord at that point was the head of policy planning, and they did a remarkable job in helping the Secretary of State. But in other cases, which is more typical, the policy planning director doesn't have any influence, and nobody cares, and the rest of the building can shut it out.
I see. Yeah, interesting. Up and down. Another question I'm curious to ask you involves your relationship to what you might say is, the world of official political theorists. I mean, you are a very clear-cut individual working in a very unusual career pattern doing the sort of political theory you're doing. How are you responded to by professors of political theory, people who are interested in John Rawls? I was thinking, when reading your book, it's almost the anti-Rawls. Here's Rawls dealing with great hypotheticals. What would our world be like if none of us knew who we were, what our economic status was, what our ethnic background was? Then we'd be able to create justice. You're going back, as you say, to hunters and gatherers and getting the detail. Mm-hmm. Do you find that other sort of political theory interesting? Do you think it's just spinning wheels?
Yeah, I think we live in blissful ignorance of one another. I don't read them, and they don't read me.
Okay. All right.
I did come out of one specific philosophical tradition, which was, Alan Bloom was an early teacher of mine, mm-hmm. And he's the one that persuaded me to learn Greek and read Plato and Aristotle. And so, and I think that kind of humanistic education has stood me in great stead because what it did is it introduced you to all of the great, mm-hmm. minds of the Western tradition. And I don't regret that for a minute. And I think it's actually terrible, all these kids that, as freshmen, they say, okay, I got to get into business school or law school. So, mm-hmm. What practical courses can I take that, will help me land a job right away? And it, they close their mind then to, great ideas. And this, Socrates, said, what is the right way to live, and how do we determine that, and how do we reason, together about that? And I don't, if you haven't had exposure to ideas at that level, I just don't think you can really think your way through mm-hmm. the practical problems.
Yeah, and I'd have to say, I think I have always leaned toward your kind of very empirical thinking, and it's interesting to me that since Rawls died and a lot of information has come out about him and how he did form his political beliefs. I mean, he fought in the U.S. Army mm-hmm. in the Pacific and had some horrific experiences and lots of chancy near misses, and it made a big difference the way he actually developed this abstract theory. Mm-hmm. You wrote an interesting piece, I thought a very cogent piece, in the Wall Street Journal a while back, a few weeks ago, about China and the possibility of, the air of unrest in the Middle East going to China. Could you say a little bit of what you argued in that?
Well, the question that's been on everybody's mind is that since one authoritarian regime after another has been toppling in the Arab world, is that contagion going to spill over to the biggest authoritarian regime of them all, which is China? And, what I argued is that in some sense the dry tinder is there because it's a question of dignity. Authoritarian regimes do not recognize the dignity of their citizens. So in the case of Tunisia, this Mohamed Bouazizi, the vegetable seller, had his cart confiscated. He complained. Nobody listened. He was slapped by the police woman. And finally, he immolated himself because of his despair over his being a non-entity in the eyes of the authorities. And this happens in China all the time. I was in Beijing in December, and one of my young Chinese interlocutors was saying one of the reasons that the film Avatar was so popular in China is it's all about this big faceless corporation taking land from these simple indigenous people, and that happens every day in China, that some peasant gets their land taken away by a corrupt official and a developer and so forth. But all of that being said, I don't think the Chinese regime is going to fall anytime soon because, and again, this is really one of the central things. I've got 6 chapters in this book on China, and I think that you really see the legacy of the Chinese historical accomplishment, which is high-quality, authoritarian, bureaucratic government. And they do that better than anyone in the world. And so they're actually responsive. If they have a corrupt official that comes to the surface and people start complaining, they actually execute that. I mean, there's really a lot of accountability there. I mean, you know, they've presided over this economic miracle, and I think that most people living today in China, when they compare their lives now to what it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they're so much materially better off, and the stability that the regime has provided is such that, you know, they don't want to risk any of that. And then, you know, finally, Chinese are just really good at being authoritarian. So you go to China and you try to get on your Facebook and you can't because it's all blocked. Unlike, you know, Mubarak and Ben Ali that, you know, let Facebook proliferate all over the place.
Yeah, you made a good point in that article about the cat and mouse game. Like, there are 6 hours to read about this before they catch on and they knock it off. But here's an issue that I don't know your position on, but it seems to me one that comes up a lot with, you know, people in liberal democracies and what their relationship should be to authoritarian countries, dictatorships, and that's engagement. We have this argument all the time at Penn in regard to Chinese programs and so on. You know, should you play ball with such governments? Should you go visit? Should you run programs there? We've got a lot of American universities now opening up campuses in dictatorial places. You know, there's powerful arguments that you're going to help change it toward democracy. And then there are also powerful arguments saying, no, you're help perpetuating these regimes because if they can do business as usual with the world of liberal democracy, they don't have to change. How do you feel about these issues of engagement?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a difference between engagement and appeasement. And I think you need to engage even the worst enemies, but you don't need to appease them. So, and this is what I think a lot of the critics of Obama kind of miss when they say, you know, you're appeasing your enemies and bowing down to them and so forth. I think that one of the problems in Bush's foreign policy was this very stiff-necked attitude that if they're a dictatorship, we're just going to sanction them and hope that they, you know, their regime collapses and have nothing to do with them. And particularly with a powerful economic force like China, that's a crazy, you know, position. They didn't take it with China, but they certainly took it with a lot of other regimes. And I think, you know, you've got to explore whether there's a possibility for living with some countries that you don't like, because if you assume that every country that you don't like is going to suddenly dissolve the way the Soviet Union dissolved, you're going to be waiting a long time. And I actually think that that was an illusion that a lot of people in the Bush administration had. After 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, they hoped that if they were just, you know, kind of firm, you know, enough that all of their enemies would collapse, like the Wicked Witch of the West when she got the water thrown on her and the Munchkins, you know, got up and danced and so forth. But you don't want to appease countries. And so I think that, there's a difference between seeing whether the Iranians might want to negotiate about their nuclear program and then actually, you know, kind of helping them or, you know, sweeping under the rug evidence of a covert weapons program just because you want to keep open lines of communication. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is really wrong.
Do you think there's anything to the idea that you look at other, when you're looking outward from a liberal democracy, you look at other countries and sort of rank them hierarchically by their heinousness, you know? It almost seems sometimes as you're reading the paper that, you know, like, say the Obama administration, the way, okay, Syria has killed 150, killed 200. When they hit 400, we'll get tough. That it depends. How bad is this regime?
Well, I mean, look, it's not quite as simple math as that. But, yeah, everybody has to make these distinctions. Mm-hmm. In North Korea, for example, a lot of people don't realize it, but the average height of the Korean population has fallen by maybe 2 inches over the last 30, 40 years because of persistent famine and malnutrition. Right? It's a really horrible regime. I mean, so you compare them to China, you could say, well, they're both communist authoritarian dictatorships, but the Chinese government actually kind of cares about whether its population is well-fed and economically prospering. And so not to make a distinction between these regimes, I think, is really both crazy and irresponsible. Mm-hmm.
I just want to ask another question or two, then we'll open it up to the audience. Let me ask a question about writing. So many academics write badly and can't communicate their ideas. You write very well, I think. But do you think much about your writing when you're thinking about a book like this, which has so much complex material, so much sheer factual data to bring across to the reader? How much do you think about your sentences, whether you need to explain concepts?
Well, yeah, I've always been blessed with the ability to write pretty quickly. And I think it's also partly my career path, because I went into a think tank early in life. I didn't try to get tenure. I think actually tenure is a terrible institution. And it's terrible not just because you might think that I've got this anti-academic bias here, but it's not just bad because it protects elderly professors. It's actually bad for what it does to younger professors, because they're all bucking for tenure, and again, they've all got to write in jargon because they've got to jump through these disciplinary hoops. And I didn't have to do that. You know, I got tenure without having come up through the ranks that way. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been able to write books that are aimed at a more general public. And I've tried to bury the more academic stuff in the footnotes. So actually, in this book, I've got this long-running argument with rational choice political scientists, but you'll never see a word of this in the text, because I just figure that a normal person could care less about, you know, this particular methodological, you know, dispute that exists in the academy. But it's there if you go
good
through
decision,
the footnote.
Right. Yeah. I do want to note that the tenured professors in the audience did not applaud. All right. So why don't we open it up? Questions from the right here? Yeah. Oh, microphone coming, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, you just mentioned think tanks, which is the question I've had in my mind ever since you started talking. You know a lot about think tanks, I'm sure. They're a fairly unique American institution, particularly the foreign policy think tanks. Mm-hmm. So I would like to ask you whether on balance you think that they have contributed positive things, or they are neutral, or they have created damage. When you look at the sweep of history, the last 40, 50 years or something like this, you know, is this a positive thing mm-hmm. in our country or not?
Oh, I think it's absolutely positive. And again, you have to compare it to other societies. In Europe, you know, they don't have think tanks, or not nearly the same density of think tanks. And, you know, it's where you formulate policies. And so because we have an alternation of parties in, you know, in government, you know, when a new party comes into power, they need a program. Now, a lot of times, you know, if you're a liberal and it's the American Enterprise Institute that's giving George Bush a lot of ideas, you don't like that. But, you know, but when Obama comes in, you know, the Brookings Institution empties out, and, you know, you've got a similar group of people that have also been spending their years in the wilderness actually, you know, trying to think through what would we do if we, you know, if we were back in power. And there's a kind of, the other thing that I think think tanks do is they connect intellectuals with practical politics and practical policy issues. I'll give you an example. I've gotten to know both Bernard Henri Lévy and André Glucksmann and some of these European philosophes, you know, intellectuals. And I remember Bernard Henri Lévy, actually both of them, I got into the same argument with both of them. So this was at the time of the Georgia invasion by Russia. And I was opposed right from the beginning to allowing Georgia to enter NATO. And the reason I was opposed to this was my training, you know, when I worked at the RAND Corporation, which does, you know, they work for the Air Force and the U.S. Army and the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And the one thing that you know, if you know anything about military logistics, is it is completely impossible for the United States to militarily support Georgia, right on the border of Russia, you know, so far away from Europe and everything else. And the NATO guarantee is a very solemn one. It says an attack on one country is an attack on the whole alliance. And so it just seemed to me right from the start that our playing around with offering them NATO membership was just completely irresponsible. Mm. And I said this, and both, you know, BHL and Glucksmann were just outraged, because for them it's a moral question, you know. Well, of course we want to stand with the Georgians, and, you know, how could you not? It's like, you know, child torture or something to, take the position that you shouldn't help them. And, I think the reason is that in Europe, if you're that kind of intellectual, you actually never have to worry about military logistics, It just never crosses your mind that what you want to do, ideally, could be affected by certain just mundane realities of, how you get a C-130, across the, the Caucasus range and get it there, before the Russians, cross the. Speaking of philosophers, there's another famous academic philosopher that I ran into at a conference recently, who made this.
Say the name, please.
I'll tell you later. And he said, it's just outrageous that, the developed world could decide to end poverty tomorrow in the developing world if they chose to, and they just, they just don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been running an international development program at Johns Hopkins for the last few years. All of my students are the bleeding hearts in the school. They're all the ones that are going to go out and work for NGOs, Catholic Relief Services, so forth, in villages in Africa. And the one thing that I know, working in this field, is that there is no way that a simple decision on the part of, Congress, to raise the amount of foreign aid given is going to end poverty in the developed. It's just, it's an absurd proposition. And I think, again, it reflects a kind of intellectual, distance from the real world. So this gets back to your earlier question, I guess, also, that it really helps to be grounded, I think, in a lot of practical realities.
And I'm sure that fellow had tenure.
He did, yes.
Although I have to say for BHL that, he has his own planes and can probably buy Georgia.
Yeah,
so
that's
right. That probably has some effect. You have a question? Yeah, right there. Mm-hmm.
Right here?
Yeah.
Good evening, sir. I have a question about your first book. I wonder if you allow it. You said that the logical destination of history is liberal democracy. Two things. I wonder about your what do you think of the logical contradiction about the free will, that the free will, for the free will to exist, that will must will freely. And also, the second thing, the inventor of democracy, they assume that if a free human being will choose freely, that human being will choose the right thing. And if they will not choose, even if they will choose the wrong thing, they will still be responsible for the consequence of their choices because they choose those choices freely.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so I believe in free will. I never took the position of certain Marxists that history was driven by these big social forces and individuals couldn't really stand up against it. And in fact, I think my new book has a number of cases like this. Pope Gregory VII that led the investiture conflict was this titanic individual. And if he hadn't existed or he hadn't made the personal choices that he made, the whole, rise of a European legal order would have been, would not have occurred in the way that it did. So, and every one of us, makes choices as citizens, and we can affect, the nature of our democracy, of the outcomes for people all over the place. And none of this is determined for us. We obviously operate with constraints, but we can also make choices. Now, do democracies... or voters in democracies always make good choices? Well, no. I think it's pretty clear that, they can make some pretty rotten choices, and it's always been a struggle in, I think the best gloss you can put on it is Abe Lincoln's, where he said, you can fool some of the voters all of the time and all of the voters some of the time, but you can never fool all of them all of the time. I would modify that to say that, in the course of deliberation and democratic, argumentation, eventually Americans come around to the right decision. But they sure don't do it in the short term. But then when you say that, the question is, so what's the alternative? What's the alternative you're gonna pose? Are you gonna go to a Chinese-style system where you say, we're gonna take these really well-educated people, we're gonna cloister them, and just let them make all the decisions, and the hell with, any kind of discussion or popular input? That may work for the Chinese, but it sure isn't going to work for our society. And so I think we're stuck with a system in which we deliberate, we bumble along, we experiment freely, we make mistakes, and then we can learn from our mistakes. And I think, you know, in the end, that's, you know, it's not that bad a system.
How about right here? Yeah.
In the past year, we've had a couple of very interesting elections. We've had the British elections and emergence of a sort of coalition government there. And we've had the Nigerian elections. And I wonder if you could reflect on both of those in terms of their respective states. Particularly, you talked about Afghanistan and how it wasn't really coming together as a state as we'd like to envision it. You know, is a state like Nigeria never going to come together? I mean, in the post-election period, and the election was said to be one of the fairest that has been in Nigeria in years, we have seen a lot of violence. And it's very different, obviously, than a substantive democracy like Britain and what's emerged there.
Mm-hmm.
If you could reflect on that, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, again, this is part of the motivation for writing The Origins of Political Order, because I believe that we all who live in a rich democracy, liberal democracy, suffer from a kind of historical amnesia about how we got to where we are. So this is what I described as this getting to Denmark, you know, problem. We don't know, and I've, you know, the Danes don't understand how they got to be Denmark. I know this because I have a visiting professorship in Denmark, and I've talked to a lot of them, and it's a big mystery there as well. But, you know, if you look, for example, so the big problem in a lot of African countries is that there is no nation. There's a state that rules over ethnic groups, tribes, but there is no sense of a common, you know, identity. And Nigeria is very much like that, because you've got this Muslim north and the Christian south. Reason that the Nigerian election is being contested, it was a free and fair election, but the Muslims thought it was their turn to have a Muslim president, and instead you elected a Christian one. Now, this is not an unheard of, you know, story in European political development. France, you know, we now think of France as a relatively homogeneous country. Everybody speaks, you know, one kind of French, but that wasn't true 4 or 5 centuries ago. You had the Languedoc and the Languedoy and the, you know, different, you know, in Bretagne, you know, and different languages in all sorts of different parts of France. You had subdivisions, Flanders and the Franche-Comté were all quite, you know, both ethnically and linguistically different. And it took actually a French government using its power to unify the language and the school system and to use the education system so that a single form of French was now taught and spoken based on a single curriculum to create, you know, the France that we know today. And that was a process that took, you know, 200-300 years to accomplish. And so, you know, how long has Nigeria been an independent country? It's, you know, really not since the 1960s. There are actually other countries that have begun this process. The two favorite ones I have are Indonesia and Tanzania, both of which actually, like the French several centuries ago, decided to develop national languages. They're ethnically highly divided countries, and so the Tanzanians developed Kiswahili and the Indonesians developed Bahasa, which were not the dominant majority languages. They're kind of new languages that were deliberately created in order to create a better sense of national identity. And, you know, Tanzania has not suffered from the kind of ethnic cleavages that neighboring Kenya has, precisely because their leaders implemented this kind of long-term nation-building process. So it can happen, and it, you know, it can happen in the contemporary developing world, but I just think we need to be a little bit, give them a little slack, because, you know, it wasn't so easy when it happened in Europe and other parts of the developed world.
More? Sir? Over right here? Yeah.
In the 1950s, I recall reading a book by Gunnar Myrdal, Third World Dilemma. And it's difficult to summarize his thesis in a sentence or two, but the basic thought was that the, let's call it first world countries, would find it in their economic self-interest to foster development of infrastructure and, let's say, economic activity in the third world, and corruption was there, and you had to deal with it, et cetera. And he predicted that, based on what was then going on in the world, that the two countries or two areas that would come out of third world status and into the, say, first world status were Israel and Puerto Rico. And he proved to be correct. And I'm interested in knowing what you think.
Well, you know, the one thing that, you know, that doesn't take account of is actually the rise of Asia, because Puerto Rico and Israel are not the only success stories in, you know, in the period since Gunnar Myrdal wrote that book. And I think that, you know, the kind of Asian miracle and the rise of, you know, Singapore, Hong Kong, China, Korea, Malaysia, and so forth is a testimony to the fact that actually global integration, you know, under a market economy actually works as a powerful engine of development. But the key ingredient to that is actually having a coherent government, because the market does not take care of itself. The market is absolutely dependent on having certain institutions. So if you don't have property rights, if you don't have a legal system, if you don't have a rule of law and a way of adjudicating commercial disputes, nobody's going to invest and you're not going to get this long-term growth. And I think if there's a single reason why, you know, Asia went one way and sub-Saharan Africa went another way, it's that lack of institutions, that basic lack of coherent political institutions. And then many, the World Bank actually just published their World Development Report, which is on violence. If you're engaged in a bloody civil war like Sierra Leone and Liberia and Sudan have been, you're also not going to develop. And so it turns out that I feel very good about this being a political scientist, because the economists have finally woken up to the fact that the kinds of things that I study are actually important for their work, their line of work. That if you don't have institutions, you know, you're not going to develop. And I'm not sure that Myrdal exactly had that insight, you know, when he wrote that book.
Back there? Yeah. How do you assess Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State, and how do you compare her performance with that of her recent predecessors?
Your job's on the line, that future job.
Well, okay. So I think that let's just go back over the last three secretaries of state. You know, Colin Powell was a decent guy and was, you know, probably the most honorable guy in the Bush administration, but he was, the odds were stacked against him because he was not part of that inner circle. I actually think that he could have exercised a lot more leverage than he did, because the threat to resign would have been taken seriously by President Bush, and there are various points at which he was being walked over by Rumsfeld and Cheney and so forth, and if he had used that threat a little bit more strongly, I think he could have, slowed down the whole march to war and so forth. Whether he could have actually stopped it, given what people thought at that time about WMD and so forth, I don't know. So that's the thing that I would really fault him for, in a sense, not really standing up for what he seems to have believed, except in retrospect. Condi Rice is actually an old friend of mine. I've known her ever since she was a graduate student. I mean, she came as a summer intern at RAND where I was working, and she could speak both Russian and Czech, and just written her dissertation on the Czech military, which I thought was pretty impressive. And again, given the hand that she was dealt and given the president she was working for, she did a reasonable job, because, you know, she was obviously, I mean, if you read, I haven't read it, but I take it if you read Rumsfeld's, new memoir, he's constantly blaming her for everything, which means that she must have been doing something worthwhile. You know, and so the Bush administration, you know, when she became Secretary of State, actually moved back into a more engaged and, I think, you know, more moderate and more multilateral, you know, mode of operation than had been the case under the first, you know, under the first secretary. But the, you know, the basic problem was that they were working on, you know, for a president that wanted to invade Iraq, and you know, it was just a fundamental mistake. And so I think their records are, you know, forever going to be tarnished by the fact that they made that mistake. Now, Hillary Clinton, I would say, has done a good job as Secretary of State. She seems to have been a little bit more forward-leaning in some areas in, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth than the president, which, you know, I think is fine. I think they had a very complex hand dealt to them with this Arab uprisings, and I think they've done, you know, they've kind of muddled through, and in the end they've come out okay. I don't think they've made any really horrible mistakes at that point. And it's a, you know, it's a fiendishly complicated situation, because here you're kind of worrying about what to do about, you know, Misrata and helping the forces in Misrata, and in the meantime, a actually potentially far more dangerous situation is materializing in Yemen, where you've actually got al-Qaeda and a lot of other people, and, you know, how many hours in the day does Hillary Clinton have to, you know, to worry about that? So,
Others? All the way in the back there?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you for your comments today. I had a question for you about Brazil and the posture of the United States with respect to Brazil and countries like Brazil that are emerging, which I think is a bit of a kind of a misstated term. Is it something that's going to be welcomed by the policymakers, by the legislators in Congress, by the folks in the executive branch? Because my sense is that there's not enough of requisite attention paid to those types of relationships and relationships like that in relation to how the world is going to look going forward. And I think that, you know, I think that attention needs to be paid to
yeah.
that. I want to know what you think.
Well, look, I go to Latin America more than any other part of the world, and, you know, I pay a lot of attention. And the one thing that you can definitely say is that nobody in Washington cares about Latin America, including Brazil, which is an incredibly big and impressive country. You know, the last time, I mean, how many of you have been on a regional jet lately that's been an Embraer that's actually manufactured by the, you know, the Brazilians? You know, the kinds of things that they're doing in offshore, you know, deep water drilling, I mean, it's an amazingly capable country. And I think, you know, we've not been, the president has not been resisting a close relationship with Brazil. But, you know, when you're worrying about the Middle East exploding, there's, you know, you don't pay that much attention to a country that's not threatening to get nuclear weapons or, you know, cause trouble in some other way. But I do think that, you know, the Brazilians themselves need to step up to the plate. And I think the new president, Dilma Rousseff, is doing that. Because I think that Lula, for all of his virtues, had a really irresponsible foreign policy. I mean, this nonsense of developing a relationship with Iran and inviting Ahmadinejad to Brazil and kind of building, you know, him up was just, you know, was a silly policy and unworthy of, you know, a serious country, a regional leader. And I think that, you know, the current president has been rolling a lot of that back. And so my hope is that actually Brazil will step up to the plate. It will become a defender of human rights and democracy around the world. And, you know, when that happens, I think the U.S. and Brazil can actually have a pretty good partnership.
Yeah. I'm told we have time for one more question. And I just wanted to say, I think in Obama's credit, you know, most people thought he was going to cancel that trip to Brazil recently because Libya was blowing up at the moment, and he didn't. You know, he said this place is important. So I thought that was a good idea. How about right here? And yeah.
I'd like to ask you about one other problematic state in the world, and that's California. I mean, here's a situation where democracy has progressed in many ways too far, to the point where the state becomes ungovernable. What is your perspective on this? Is this just an aberration which can be fixed, or is this inevitable?
No, unfortunately, all bad ideas start in California, and then they spread to the rest of the country. Yeah, no, it's been interesting having lived. I haven't lived in California since the 1980s, and it's gotten a lot worse. You know, and you think about, you know, what California did in this early period. You know, they created the University of California system. They brought all this water from the Owens Valley, and you know, made Los Angeles into a real city, and you know, all these big, you know, things. And now the state has just been reduced to, you know, this kind of beggar status. And I think it's a combination of things. You know, the referendum system is idiotic. It's just idiotic, you know, that people, there's a reason why we elect representatives, because direct democracy in a huge state like that just doesn't work. It means that, you know, it's the interest that can pay for television advertising that get their referenda approved. And then they do interesting things like a 50% majority on a referendum can pass a measure that requires a two-thirds majority, you know, to repeal, which is an interesting constitutional idea. And I think that, you know, I've actually gotten involved now with several groups that are trying to figure out a way to get out of this, you know, this mess. The one bad idea that started in California that spread to the rest of the country is the tax revolt, you know, with Proposition 13. I actually think the taxes were too high at the beginning of the Reagan administration, so there was a reason to lower marginal tax rates. But that being said, you know, this idea that you'll never, ever, ever, ever raise another tax again, and this idea that if you cut taxes, it'll automatically pay for itself in terms of greater growth, you know, it's just proven to be completely wrong. And until, you know, I think Republicans drop that ideological notion, you're just never going to fix, you know, any of these problems. And California magnifies that because they've got this rule that it takes a supermajority to actually raise taxes, and the Republicans are a permanent minority in that state, but they can still block any revenue-raising measure. And so there have been various, you know, attempts to have a new constitutional convention. I'm not sure that would work, because I think actually you'd let loose even crazier ideas. One idea that people have been thinking about is to move to an Australian-type alternative vote system, where instead of just voting for one candidate, you rank order your preferences. And the hope is that under this kind of a system, you could actually get a centrist party that would be less beholden to, you know, the two established parties. And I mean, I shouldn't let the Democrats off the hook either, because, you know, that state pioneered out-of-control pensions and, you know, public sector, you know, kind of locked in public sector salaries and so forth. And so I don't know what the solution is. I think just like for the rest of the country, things are going to get worse and worse until the crisis is so obvious and hits people over the head like a 2x4, and then finally they're going to get some sense and they're going to, you know, compromise. But I don't think we're there yet.
Well, you could just move to Australia.
I could move to Australia.
Right. And you're rejecting the thesis that the Terminator left and he terminated democracy.
You know, when I was in Australia maybe 3 years ago at the end of John Howard's reign, you know, he had been the Conservative Prime Minister of Australia, and at that point Australia had no foreign or long-term debt because the Conservative government had just, you know, they believe in balanced budgets rather than cutting taxes. And they said, okay, we're going to get to a budget balance, we're going to cut some spending, and we're going to raise taxes. And they did it, you know. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, if Americans could behave like, you know, or if Americans could behave like Australians, we'd be sitting pretty. But, you know, that's not our political culture right now.
Please join me. A wonderful guest, a brilliant book, and he'll be signing upstairs in a few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.